I was an economics and geography major in university. I thought that my geography would have a very interesting side benefit. Because when you live in the upper Midwest, in particular, a place like Minneapolis, it is an area where you need to be concerned about the possibility of tornadoes. And with my geographic training, we had a lot of study devoted to climatology. And so the city of Minneapolis is blessed by having what is called a heat island. Now let me explain what a heat island is. The yellow circle that's towards the left is Minneapolis, and then St. Paul is over in the other yellow circle. And you'll notice that there are rivers that are going through there. There's the Mississippi River and the Minnesota River. And also you'll notice that there is a place that's marked in blue. That's where I lived. That's Lauderdale. Now, Lauderdale benefited from the heat island. What is a heat island? A lot of heat is generated by all of the freeways and the tall buildings and all the things that are going on in a city. And tornadoes have this tendency to either dive up, go back up into the cloud a little while they're trying to go over a city because of the heat island effect, or they go slightly around it. There's a lot of protection unless you have a major tornado, like a Class 5 tornado. But your ordinary run-of-the-mill tornadoes, the heat island, it's a nice, safe location to be. Furthermore, as you look at places that you're trying to avoid tornadoes, you don't want to be on an east-west running river. Well, lo and behold, the river at that point is north-south. And Lauderdale is somewhat hilly. That also gives protection. But besides that, while Diane and I lived in Lauderdale, one of the TV stations, KSTP-TV in St. Paul, installed the first Doppler radar of any television station in the entire nation. And we were really thrilled because here we had this extra layer of protection that was coming in. But right at that time, Diane and I made a move down to Dallas in order for me to attend seminary. And so we left at the end of May 1981. On the 14th of June, there was a tornado. And here is the path that it took. It went from Lake Harriet right to Lauderdale. And my favorite seminary library that I lived within walking distance of lost a lot of trees from that tornado. Interestingly enough, the tornado went right over that Doppler radar of that TV station, and the Doppler radar did not pick up the tornado. It missed it. And I was just absolutely flabbergasted. Everything had gone wrong that could possibly go wrong. And I found out about it after arriving down in Dallas. And I thought, you know, the Lord is really in control of things far more than all the geographic theories and climatology theories and everything else that I had learned. But I do need to explain why it was that the Doppler radar missed it. Okay, here you have a tornado, and then there on the right is a Doppler radar. Now, as you look at the Doppler radar image, the area that's red, which is the heavy, heavy rainfall or hail that accompanies a tornado, that's part of the process, it has a hook shape, as illustrated by the hook on the left-hand side, so that the red actually makes a fish hook shape. And the Doppler radars, computers, are designed to look for that fish hook. And when they see that, they say, tornado. And that's where the warning comes in. How was it that this particular tornado was missed when it went right over the radar? Well, very simply, almost all tornadoes in the northern hemisphere are counterclockwise. When you have a counterclockwise tornado, where the winds are spinning counterclockwise, then it produces a hook like that at the left, and the computers were designed to pick that up. But a very, very small percentage of tornadoes turn clockwise. And as a result, the Doppler radar didn't even pick it up. It reminded me that what we put our eyes on for safety is sometimes just completely backwards. Just exactly the mirror image of what it was that we needed to be protected against. When we are working at the human plane, we can so easily protect ourselves against a left hook, and lo and behold, out of the blue comes a right hook. Well, that's what happened in the book of Ruth. There is a family that lived in Bethlehem that was very concerned about a huge problem that was going on, and they sought a resolution. They thought that they would spare their lives, and instead, what they experienced was death. They protected themselves against the left hook and got clobbered by a right hook. So let's take a look at the book of Ruth. We're only going to be covering five verses because this time we are going to be setting up the introduction to the book. And that's going to take a little bit of time to set up some of the things that will help us to understand this book. Let's read the passage. Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land. And a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech. The name of his wife was Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah. And they went to the country of Moab and remained there. Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left and her two sons. Now they took wives of the women of Moab. The name of one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth. And they dwelt there about 10 years. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died, so that the woman survived her two sons and her husband. We need to have an understanding here of how the book of Ruth fits within the chronology and the flow of the Old Testament. When we talk about wanting to understand whole books, well, one of those whole books that we want to understand is the Old Testament. So it's important for us to set up where is Ruth fitting within the Old Testament. I'm glad you asked about that. Well, let's look at a summary of the Old Testament books. That is, the books of the Old Testament that are chronological in nature. There are 11 of them. If you are working on a chronology of the Old Testament, there are 11 books that you want to look at that are focused upon setting forth the chronology of Israel's history. You have Genesis, and I have broken it here into Genesis 1 through 11 and 12 through 50. Genesis 1 through 11 looks at creation, the fall, the flood, and the creation of Gentile nations. Then Genesis 12 through 50 focuses upon four people: Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. It's looking at those four people and the flow of how God made promises to Israel that all of human history is going to be designed in order to carry out those promises that he had made to them. Just as the first 11 chapters set out the basics of promises that God had made to humanity in general. Then Exodus and Numbers focus upon God's deliverance through Moses. Both the Exodus, leading the people out of Egypt and preparing for that, but also then as the people were wandering in the wilderness for 40 years. So Moses is the primary character there. In the fourth book, Joshua, there's the crossing of the Jordan River into the land that God had promised, and then they took the land. After the time of Joshua's death, we enter into the fifth book, Judges. And it speaks about there being lawlessness in the land. There was no king, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. It was the period of time after the conquest of the land under Joshua, but they didn't want to undertake the cleanup operations, the mop-up military operations in order to fully possess the land. The book of Ruth occurs within the time frame of Judges. So this is the time period that we're going to be looking at. But then following that, there are the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, which are the 6th and 7th chronological books, and they focus on Samuel the prophet, Saul, the first king of Israel, David, the second king of Israel. The 8th and 9th books, 1 and 2 Kings, focus on Solomon, and then the kingdom as it split into the northern part, known as Israel, and the southern part, known as Judah, and then the decline and the fall of both of those kingdoms. And then finally, there are two more books within the chronological flow of the Old Testament, Ezra and Nehemiah. And they focus on the ministries of Ezra and Nehemiah in returning to the land that God had promised and seeing God's deliverance as they returned. So where are we in the flow of things? We're approximately the middle of the Old Testament. That is, between the period of time when God called Abraham until the time that the New Testament opened, we are right in the very middle of that time period. Let's look a little more closely at Ruth in relation to the book of Judges. When did the events of the book of Ruth occur? Well, Ruth was during the time of the judges, probably during the time that Gideon judged Israel. Now, Judges chapter 17, verse 6 gives an overall summary of what that period of time was like. And so it's the overall summary of what was occurring during the time of the judges. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. People weren't looking to the guidance from God's word. They were not looking for guidance to those that ministered his word. They weren't even looking to the judges who sought to administer God's word in terms of the administration of the country. And what happened was God needed to continually punish the nation for turning into idolatry. And then the people would turn back to the Lord and God would raise up a judge to deliver them. And guess what would happen? The people would again go into idolatry. The country would be taken over by foreign powers. The people would turn to the Lord. He would deliver them. And you have a repeated cycle during the book of Judges that the overall tendency was everyone did what was right in whose eyes? In their own eyes. And the book of Ruth occurs within that time frame. notice what it says in Ruth chapter 1, verse 1. Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled. So this is the time period when this occurs. We're going to be looking at a family that ended up doing what was right in their own eyes. What did they do when God had given command for people, especially the royal family, the ones out of whom the Messiah would be born? They of all people were supposed to remain in the land. But those of the Messianic line, Elimelech and his family, abandoned Judah, the southern part of Israel, and went to Moab because of a scarcity of food. That had also happened in earlier times. You remember how Abraham had left the land. Jacob left the land. And as we look at the Old Testament, that was never something that was endorsed by the Lord. He never endorsed for people to pick up and just move out of the land, especially those of the royal lineage. Backing up just a little bit to where we looked at the overall flow of the chronology of Old Testament books, you'll notice that there are three of these that I have put asterisks by. Genesis 1 through 11, the book of Judges, and Kings after Solomon. During those portions of the Old Testament, there's a lot of summarization in the chronological books because many characters are viewed and the books cover a rather lengthy period of time. The other portions of the Old Testament, it slows down and there's a concentration on God's deliverance through individuals like Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, Joshua, and then looking at the first kings in Israel. But during times like the book of Judges, there's a lot of material that is summarized in order to give an overall perspective, and a lengthier period of time is in view. Well, let's ask ourselves, why was the book of Ruth written? When was it written? Who is the author? What's our background on this book? Why is it that there would be a necessity to have a book within the time flow of Judges that covers a long span of time? Why is it necessary to slow down and have one little book, the book of Ruth, focusing on what happened to one family within the nation of Israel? Well, it turns out that this is an extremely important family in the flow of Israel's history. The book of Ruth was written after David became king. How do we know that? I am certainly glad you asked. Take a look at Ruth chapter 4. In Ruth chapter 4, we have the description that occurs when Boaz took Ruth to be his wife. Let's start at verse 13. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And he went in to her, that is, he went to her tent where she was. We won't go into further details. The Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Then the women said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without a close relative, a near kinsman. And may his name be famous in Israel. And may he be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. for your daughter-in-law, who loves you, who is better to you than seven sons, has borne him. Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her bosom and became a nurse to him. Also the neighbor women gave him a name, saying, "There is a son born to Naomi," and they called his name Obed. "He is the father of Jesse, the father of David." You see, this couldn't be known until David was born. Now, this is the genealogy of Perez. Perez begot Hezron. Hezron begot Ram. And Ram begot Amminadab. And Amminadab begot Nahshon. And Nahshon begot Salmon. Salmon begot Boaz. And Boaz begot Obed. Obed begot Jesse. And Jesse begot David. This is the royal lineage. And the point where this book is written is after not only has David been born, but David has become king. Who is the author? We don't know. But the best guess is very well could have been Samuel. Samuel the prophet. Because Samuel would know the importance of this particular family and of the history, because the Lord had told him to anoint David to be king over Israel. Now the question is, why is this book written? As you may remember, Saul was the first king of Israel, and to what tribe did Saul belong? The tribe of Benjamin. But what tribe was it that was going to rule over Israel? Judah. In Genesis, it was predicted that the scepter would always remain in the tribe of Judah, and that it would remain in that tribe until Shiloh would come. Now, Shiloh is a very interesting word. Shiloh means the one to whom it is, the one who owns the scepter. And guess who it is that owned the scepter, the right to rule over the nation? Jesus Christ himself. And so the pledge that God had made was that the right to rule would remain in Judah, within the lineage of Judah, until the one to whom the right to rule came, Shiloh, Jesus Christ himself. But can you imagine people saying, "Oh, David usurped the throne from Saul. And furthermore, David doesn't even have a purely Jewish lineage. Wow, there's even a Moabite woman in his ancestry. What right does he have to be the king over this nation?" Can you imagine all the concerns that were raised because there David was becoming king after Saul had been king, and how was it that the kingship did not stay within Benjamin? How did it go to David? And the book of Ruth was written in order to make it very clear that David had the right to become king. This that was told about him having a Moabite woman in his ancestry was something that was well known, but would have been problematic to some people. Just as you may remember that there were many people who raised issues about whether Jesus was legitimate. Because after all, what was this about Mary being found with child before they were married? Genealogies are extremely important things within a nation that has a king as ruler. God had made promises about the lineage through which the Messiah would come. And the book of Ruth is designed to show that David had legitimacy as king of Israel. Well, that leads us now to a consideration of the book itself. So let's move into New Exposition on page 2 of your notes. Verses 1 through 2 are going to be setting the backdrop for the story that we will be considering through the book of Ruth. During the time of the judges, an Ephrathite family of Bethlehem, Elimelech, his wife Naomi, and their sons Mahlon and Chilion, went to the plains of Moab to escape a food shortage. So during the time of the judges, an Ephrathite family of Bethlehem, Elimelech, Naomi, Mahlon, and Chilion went to the plains of Moab to escape a food shortage. And so now let's take a look at the map, and I've given you a map also in your notes, just a sketch of it. And we are going to pretend right now that this room where we are meeting is a map of Israel. So I'm up north at the Sea of Galilee. And back there where the offering box is, that's the southern end of the Dead Sea. And what that means is that there are certain geographic places that are going to become important. My son George is sitting over in Gaza. And so he's right by the Mediterranean Sea on the southern end of the country. And there are some of you on this side of the Jordan River. The Jordan River is this aisle that's going down the middle here. Some of you who are over on this side of the Jordan River are in Ammon and Moab. You're in some of the countries that are outside of Israel. As you look about to where Ryan is sitting, he's probably over there in Moab somewhere. The question becomes exactly what part of Moab it was that the family migrated to, whether it's in the area immediately to the east of the Dead Sea, up in the highland plains, the plateau of Moab, or whether they were down in the Jordan River Valley, just north of the Dead Sea. Now, Ryan, I've got to ask you a question. You know, you're right there by the Dead Sea. Now, if you go further south, you'd be at the Red Sea. Is it true that it's better to be dead than red? Now, over here on the other side of the room, about where Steve Mahoney is sitting, actually a few seats behind him, would be where Bethlehem is. So that's where the family of Elimelech and Naomi and Mahlon and Chilion are located. And so you can see where for them to cross over the Jordan River and get into Moab is not all that far from where they're located. Now, as we ask the question about, well, where are the plains of Moab? Now, that's been translated in our New King James as the country of Moab. But actually, the word means fields. So the fields of Moab. Well, that would seem to be describing an area that is relatively level rather than relatively steep. And so there are a couple of places that would qualify. As we said, one would be immediately east of the Jordan River, and the other would be east of the Dead Sea. The one that's east of the Dead Sea is it's a higher elevation, approximately 3,000 feet in elevation. Whereas if they are by the Jordan River, they're going to be about 1,000 feet below sea level. So it's somewhat important as to which one of the two they were actually located at. Now, this picture here is looking down on the plains of Moab that would be east of the Dead Sea. It is my expectation that that's probably the area that was described here in the book of Ruth. We'll get into a little bit of reasoning for that in a few moments. But let's now consider another issue. In your English Bible, you see the word in verse 1, famine. There was a famine in the land, and the word is ra'av. Now the question is, what does ra'av mean? Well, famine is a good translation in most contexts. But the word can be a little more generic than the word famine. It can mean hunger. So, for example, in Deuteronomy chapter 28, verse 48, God said, "Therefore you shall serve your enemies, whom the Lord will send against you, in hunger," and that's the word ra'av, "in thirst, in nakedness, and in need of everything. And he will put a yoke of iron on your neck until he has destroyed you." Notice how hunger is paired up with thirst, nakedness, and being in need of everything. The word can be a generic reference to being hungry. When we hear the word famine, we tend to think of there being a drought and crop failures. So the question now becomes, is Ruth telling us that there was a crop failure because of a drought, or is it a different set of circumstances that are in view? Under most circumstances, it wouldn't be all that big a deal. But here, I don't think that it was a crop failure. I think that the hunger was for a different reason. Now, this picture is not in Israel. Where do you think this picture was taken? See the nice lake there? Where do you think that this was taken? This is in Death Valley. Now the question is, what year was this picture taken? What year was there a lake, a large lake, at the bottom of Death Valley? It isn't this year. I mean, after all, right now we are having about the worst drought that Southern California has ever had. And so if we are having that on the western end, what do you think it's like in Death Valley? I guarantee you, there's no lake in Death Valley. This picture was taken during our last El Nino. This picture was taken on March the 9th, 2005, when there was so much water and so much snow that even Death Valley got more than its share. It got a once-in-a-century amount of rainfall and snow. And so for several days, they had a lake down there at the bottom of Death Valley. The point is, if we were to consider the map, if in Bethlehem, which is circled by the red oval, if they're having a drought in Bethlehem, what do you think is going along in the plains of Moab? They're also going to have a drought. So would it be possible for, or would it be likely for Elimelech and his family to be able to escape a drought by moving further east? That's like saying, well, we're having a drought. Move east, go to Death Valley, and maybe it'll be rainier. Okay? Do you see why I object to the translation famine? Because when we see famine, we're tending to think lack of rainfall. And that's making it look as though they moved in order to be in a place where there would be more rain and they would escape the drought. Instead, the idea here is it was a time of hunger in the land. Now, what else could produce hunger? Well, obviously, you could have pestilence. You could have insects that were going after the crops. You could also have war. Now, what was the time period that the book of Ruth was written during? The time of the judges. When every man did what was right in his own eyes. And you remember how there were repeated cycles within the book of Judges where people would turn into idolatry, and then God would discipline them as everyone did what was right in his own eyes, and they were worshiping all the foreign idols, and then there would be a foreign power that would come in and create havoc. And then during the time of discipline, people would start praying to the Lord, and God would raise up a deliverer. He would raise up a judge who would deliver the people. That, I believe, is the background for the book of Ruth. And it's going to be an extremely important thing for us to be aware of that. There are passages, especially in chapter 3 and some other places within Ruth, that make much more sense if we understand that it is a time of political instability, a time when there are foreign invaders in the land. I'd like for us now to turn back to the book of Judges, and let's look at Judges chapter 6. Judges 6 describes one of the judges that came to power, that the Lord raised up to deliver the people. And his name was Gideon. But let's look at what had occurred prior to the book of Ruth. Notice the end of chapter 5 is describing the time that Deborah was judging over the land of Israel, and there was peace in the land. Notice the last verse of Judges chapter 5. Thus let all your enemies perish, O Lord, but let those who love him be like the sun when it comes out in full strength. So the land had rest for 40 years. Chapter 6, verse 1. Then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. They forgot the Lord who had delivered them. So the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian for 7 years. Now the Midianites were a nomadic tribe, and they lived in places like Moab. And we find them dwelling in Moab and Ammon and other places to the east of the Jordan River and to the east of the Dead Sea. And we find them appearing at various times within the Old Testament. And the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel. Because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made for themselves dens, the caves and the strongholds which are in the mountains. It sounds like conditions were becoming rather difficult as people are looking for places to hide. They're not looking for standing up and fighting against the Midianites. They're looking for a place to escape, a place to hide. They're looking at caves. They're looking at dens. They're looking at secluded mountain hideouts. So it was, whenever Israel had sown, whenever they planted seeds, whenever they planted their fields, the Midianites would come up. Now, they didn't come at sowing time. But when would they come? They would come right at harvest time. And, you know, the Midianites didn't come in and say, oh, well, get out of the way and we'll come and we'll harvest your crop and we'll thresh it and we'll take it. It's, no, we'll let you reap it, we'll let you thresh it, and then we'll come and drive you out, and we'll load it on wagons and haul it back to where we live. They wanted for the Israelites to go to all of the work to plant the crops, to harvest the crops, to process the crops, and then they would come in and steal it. So it was an annual thing that at harvest time, in would come the Midianites. And the Midianites were powerful enough that for 7 years, they were able to do this at will. Then they would encamp against them. So it was, whenever Israel had sown, the Midianites would come up, also the Amalekites, and the people of the east would come up against them. So people would cross over the Jordan River and come into Israel. Notice that it says, then they would encamp against them and destroy the produce of the earth as far as Gaza. Clear down there where my son George is sitting. And there would also be destruction of crops that would happen in the vicinity of where Steve is sitting, in Bethlehem area. But you'll notice on this map here, there's also another place that is circled. You can see Gaza, and then you can see the red oval where Bethlehem is, and then to the northeast of that, you see another place. And that's Orpha. And the reason for Orpha being mentioned is that's where Gideon lived. And we're going to run into a description of Gideon. So way down in the south, Gaza, and further north as well. And they would leave no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep nor ox nor donkey. For they would come up with their livestock and their tents, coming in as numerous as locusts, both they and their camels, were without number, and they would enter the land to destroy it. So Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord, and the Lord delivered them. And it came to pass, when the children of Israel cried out to the Lord because of the Midianites, that the Lord sent a prophet to the children of Israel and said to them, thus says the Lord God of Israel, I brought you up from Egypt and brought you out of the house of bondage. And I delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of all who oppressed you and drove them all out before you and gave you their land. Also I said to you, I am the Lord your God. Do not fear the gods of the Amalekites or the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But you have not obeyed my voice. Now the angel of the Lord, that's Jesus himself, came and sat under the terebinth tree, which was at Ophrah, which belonged to Joash. The Abiezrite, while his son Gideon threshed wheat in the winepress. Do you normally thresh wheat in a wine press? No, that's not a logical place to be threshing. It wasn't that Gideon had lost his marbles. Look at what the rest of the verse tells us as to why he was doing that there, in order to hide it from the Midianites. He put his grain in his wine press. And that was where he threshed because he figured, well, at least that way, that part of his crop would be safe from the Midianites. So notice, this is a rather large area that's being covered because we can see Gaza, we can see Bethlehem, and we can also see the area of Ophrah up beyond Bethlehem and Jerusalem. In other words, the Midianites were free to come and go as they chose, and anywhere that there were crops, they were sure to be there at harvest time. The Midianites were not looking to occupy the land and to stay there. They would come in. They were opportunists. They were nomadic, and they came in at harvest time. And the Lord delivered the nation during the time of Gideon. We're not going to go into further development, but as we continue in the book of Judges, the deliverance that God gave through Gideon is described. Remember, we observed that Joshua had led the conquest of the land. In a 7-year period of time, he conquered the land, and then we enter the period of the judges. What was supposed to happen in the period of the judges? God commanded the Israelites to go and to do mop-up operations and to take over the rest of the land in order to take full possession of it. When Joshua went in to conquer, he defeated the major armies, but there were still pockets of resistance. I think we can identify with that. When we think about the operations that took place in Afghanistan and Iraq, remember how quickly it was possible to take care of the main forces. But notice the long and difficult process that is required in order to clean up and to make an area safe. During the time of the judges, there were still the pockets of resistance, and the country had not yet organized in the way that the Lord had designed for it to be organized under effective, godly leadership. And how was it that the country was conducted? The law of the land was everyone did what was right in his own eyes. We are blessed to live in a country of laws, a country of order. We obviously can point to problems there within our nation, and those problems have always been here. But it is a land where the rule of law is a characteristic of our country. And we can thank the Lord for the freedom that we have that has come by those who have been willing to stand up for our freedom. Those that have been involved in our military forces from the day that this nation was founded to the present day. And those in the police forces and in the government who are there to protect our God-given right to worship Him and to live in a country where there is sufficient order that we have the freedom to worship and to evangelize freely, to tell people of the gift of everlasting life. So, as I had said, the book of Ruth didn't necessarily seem like the most logical place for a Memorial Day service, but it is. When we understand that the setting, the backdrop for what is going on in the book of Ruth is a complete breakdown in a society after the time of the godly leadership of Joshua, to the time where every man did what was right in his own eyes. And look at what they reaped. It was such an awful period of time that people like Elimelech refused to stay in the land, and they abandoned the land of Israel. They went off to Moab. One of the reasons that I would argue that the terrain east of the Dead Sea is a more likely location for the for where it is that Elimelech would have gone. It is an area that if you were to look at a map, you would see that there are deep canyons separating the level areas. It's not particularly easy for raiding parties to go from one part of Moab to the other because it's divided up by great canyons. Then you have the level land that occurs up on the high plateaus, and there's sufficient rainfall for crops to be raised. I think that what Elimelech was looking for was a place of security, a place where there was greater order, but also a place where crops could be grown. And Moab looked like the ideal place, but he left the land of Israel. He left the land of Judah, where he, as part of the royal line of all people, was supposed to stay. But as we return now to Ruth chapter 1, the family of Elimelech was in Bethlehem, and because of the problems that were happening, because of the Midianites and others coming in, they did not feel safe. They feared for their lives and they left. Isn't that ironic? They feared for their lives. They wanted to stay alive, and what happened when they moved to the fields of Moab? Death came upon the family. It came upon the father. It came upon the sons. And there were three widows that were left in Moab: Naomi, Orpah, and Ruth. Now notice that we're told that he was a man of Bethlehem within the tribal region of Judah. And so he and his wife and his two sons went. His name was Elimelech, his wife was Naomi, and his sons were Mahlon and Chilion. Now it says here that they were Ephrathites. Now the question is, why is it describing them as Ephrathites? Well, some people view it as a synonym for Bethlehem, and others regarded as a royal clan that lived around Bethlehem among other clans that lived around Bethlehem. Let's look first at Genesis chapter 35, verse 19. And as people have looked at that passage and a few others, they have taken it that this is just another name for Bethlehem. Genesis chapter 35, verse 19. So Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is, Bethlehem. And so they said, well, the old name was Ephrath, and the new name is Bethlehem, so Moses is trying to update the readers so that they know where Ephrath is. Okay, well, that's one possibility, but let's now look at 1 Samuel chapter 17. 1 Samuel is the book right after Ruth. So 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 12. Now, David was the son of that Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse, and who had eight sons. Now, notice that he is an Ephrathite who lived in Bethlehem. So, in other words, it's pointing towards it being a clan that is there. Now, as we look at the passage in Genesis chapter 35, it tells us that Rachel was buried on the road to Ephrath. She was buried on the road to the area where the Ephrathites lived. Well, where was it that the Ephrathites lived? Bethlehem. But does that say that Ephrath equals Bethlehem? No. So as we understand it more carefully, it is a clan. It is the royal clan. The family of David was of the family of Ephrath. That was one of the clans that lived around Bethlehem. So what we are being told here in Ruth is that one of the leading clans of the area around Bethlehem is the family to which Elimelech belonged. He, of all people, should have remained in the land. But he feared for his life and fled. Now, the question becomes, what does the term Bethlehem mean? Well, Bethlehem is house of bread. Any idea why Bethlehem would get the name house of bread? Well, it's the bread basket. It's the wheat and barley belt area of Israel. That was an area that would receive particular attention from the Midianites because that's where most of the wheat was. That's where most of the barley was. And the book of Ruth is focusing upon the barley harvest. And about 7 weeks after the barley harvest would have been the wheat harvest. And so as we look at the book of Ruth, Ruth went out to glean in the barley fields, and her plan was to remain there and to then again glean when the wheat harvest would come. But that obviously was a place where the Midianites would spend a lot of time because there was a lot of grain there. It was like being in the wheat belt of the United States. It was the primary place to get your wheat and the primary place in Israel to get your barley. Isn't it ironic? Elimelech left the house of bread to get bread. He left the wheat belt to get wheat. Isn't it ironic? There is a way that seems right to a man, but it is the way of death, as Proverbs tells us. He was looking to protect himself against the left hook, and lo and behold, he got hit by the right hook. He wasn't operating in keeping with what the Word of God would have instructed him. So there they are in the fields of Moab, and they remained there. It wasn't their intention to be there for the rest of their lives, although in the case of the males, they were there for the rest of their lives. They thought that their life was their own and that they would live longer and that they would live to return to Judah once the political situation had stabilized, but that was not to be. Verse 3, then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left and her two sons. Elimelech died, leaving only Naomi and her sons. This was a move that they had made in desperation to save their lives, and everything came crashing down. Naomi is there with her two sons. They're foreigners in the land of Moab. Well, in verse 4, in the course of time, Mahlon and Chilion married. So they took Moabite wives, but they had no children after 10 years of marriage. The way that the Hebrew is set up here, verse 4 is set up as sequentially following verse 3. The point where the two sons married was after the death of Elimelech. And they remained there 10 years as married men. We don't know how long that they had lived there before Elimelech died, but we know that they were there over 10 years because the length of their marriage in Moab before they died was 10 years. So verse 4, now they took wives of the women of Moab. The name of the one was Orpah, the name of the other Ruth, and they dwelt there about 10 years. We're not told in this verse that they didn't have children, but that's clearly the import of it. Because of the inheritance laws, it's starting to look bleak. It is looking like the land that they own in Judah is going to disappear from this part of the family. Death is what has hit them ever since they came to Moab, the place that they came to spare their lives. Well, in verse 5, Mahlon and Chilion both died with no offspring. So Naomi, Ruth, and Orpah are all widows in Moab. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died, so the woman survived her two sons and her husband. This has become the place of death for Naomi. You can imagine how devastated she is at this point. It was an awful thing for them to have to leave their beloved land and to leave Judah. And then her husband died. Her sons marry foreign women. They don't have any children, and they die. And it's still the time of the judges in Judah. Can you imagine how depressing this is at this point in time for Naomi? She had everything, all of her confidences, everything she would trust in has been smashed, except one, and that's the Lord. We'll be finishing chapter 1 next week, but I'll give a little bit of an indication by us reading verse 6. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the country of Moab, in the fields of Moab, that the Lord had visited his people by giving them bread. This is not the break of a famine. It's not that suddenly there's rainfall. It is that the Lord has blessed Judah. As the people started praying to the Lord for deliverance and they turned to him, and he raised up Gideon. He raised up a deliverer to drive the Midianites out so that they could no longer keep oppressing the people. Where Elimelech had run away from the Lord to a place that became the death for him and for his family, his sons, what was the real solution? What was the alternative that should have been followed? To be praying to the Lord for deliverance. Now that's ultimately what happened. And she, Naomi, wanted to return now that she knew that the Lord had indeed delivered bread to his people by returning some stability to the land. Naomi has gotten a bad rap. She became rather distraught and was not thinking as clearly as she should have. But as we look at this passage next week, we are going to find out that Naomi is a true trophy of grace. When we start to see the depth of the understanding that is evident that she had before the death of her husband and sons, it is phenomenal. This is a woman that should be understood. As we read between the lines and we start reconstructing what is here, we will see her as a true trophy of grace because of the understanding that she had and was able to communicate to her daughters-in-law. We're going to see a passage where she is disoriented, but we're going to see the evidence of how stable she had once been. She moved to Moab, and she may well not have been in favor of that move. But her husband made the decision. She went along with the decision. And we're going to see some absolutely amazing things about Naomi next week as we finish up chapter 1. But what do we see in this passage? There was an abandonment of the land. There was a decision to protect against one problem, the problem of the Midianites stealing all of the food. And they created a new problem. Elimelech took his family to the place of death. He took them to the place away from where the Lord would have had them to be. There's a way that seems right unto men, but it is the way of death. God is the giver of life, and look at what the Lord did. He gave life in response to the prayers of the people. He protected those in Judah. And the blessing was something that Naomi could see, and she wanted to return to Judah. But beyond her wildest dreams, the Lord had even further deliverance in mind. Because through Ruth, there was a continuation of the line that would culminate in the Messiah, the ultimate giver of life, to be born in Bethlehem out of that lineage. The Lord is the one who gives life. Man cannot give life. Man can only bring death. Within that context, we know that the message that the Lord has given to us is a message of life, that Jesus Christ grants everlasting life to those who simply believe his promise of life to them. And furthermore, the Lord is also the giver of the abundant life to those who seek to be pleasing to the Lord by following what his word says. The book of Ruth is going to be giving us some clues into this from an Old Testament setting. Let's pray.